Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is February 13th, 2025, and we're talking to Yen Shin, who is professor in the Department of Neurology and the Institute for Human Genetics in the Weill Institute for Neuroscience at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. So InSLab studies non-coding regions of DNA in the human genome that regulate the expression of all the genes and how variations in the sequences of those regions impact gene expression, development, differentiation of organs and cell types, and also functions and diseases, and especially in the nervous system. I hope we'll be talking about nervous system today.
Yes.
Welcome, yeah.
Hi, everyone.
Also with us, Melanie Carles, our local human genetics and epigenetics expert, and will be familiar to everybody who follows along in the podcast, because Melanie's been on before.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks.
And I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Yen, I'd like to get started. I know there's some really interesting things to talk about, but I'd like you to start by giving us just a little tutorial on the players in the whole gene expression business, especially the ones that are DNA. So I think everybody knows about the proteins, which are the transcription factors, but there are all these non-coding pieces of DNA with names like promoter, enhancer, and silencing element and stuff like that that are not as familiar.
Yeah, certainly. You know, the genome basically express about over 2,000 protein coding genes. And to control these gene expression, we need a few elements that make it work, right? For example, you know, each gene has a promoter that initiates transcription. And once its transcription starts, you get messenger RNA that's ultimately translated to protein that everybody are familiar with. But in order to have the promoter start transcription, we still need additional elements. For example, you know, distal sequences that can control promoter, usually we call it enhancers or cis-regulatory elements. So these are the promoter of the promoter, where you know the transcriptional factor are being recruited on these sequences, and they can go after to their target genes and recruit general transcriptional factors and transcription machinery that initiate transcription.
So all of them are binding sites for the transcription factors. So there's always has to be a protein there that the DNA interacts with.
Yeah, it's
there's
almost
no DNA to DNA regulation kind of.
Yeah. You need to have it has to be mediated by protein such as transcription factor or even general transcription machinery like GTF, like you know TAF2, these kind of things. And then those sequences, these distal sequences, they are of course not part of the coding region. They are in the non-coding region, which basically is 98% of our human genome. And in these regions contain many of such regulatory sequences that control cell type specific gene regulation. This is fundamentally why we have, you know, the same human, the same individual with exact same genetic blueprint of every single cell, but you have different functional organs.
So what's the difference between a promoter and an enhancer?
So promoters are the usually right before the transcription start site. And then they are bound by POR2, right? This is where the transcription starts. And so it's very easy to identify promoters because it's next to the gene by itself. And, you know, but then for enhancer, on the other hand, is basically a sequence could be in anywhere and usually working from distal so that, you know, it's really hard to resolve what their target genes are because we don't know the directionality of these sequences. And they are distal sequences that contain transcriptional factor binding motif that can further recruit transcription factor.
So we could imagine a transcription factor bound to a promoter, and then there are all of these possible enhancers also attached to the transcription factor that have come from who knows where.
So one of the mechanism for the enhancers to work is for chromatin loops between the enhancer and the promoter they control, right? So if you read the DNA sequence in linear relationship, like there's no way you can figure out, oh, this promoter is controlled by this enhancer that's like a few KB away. However, in reality, you know, the DNA is being organized in a way that it's being, they can form loops between promoter and enhancer. They can form large domains or territories, like, you know, so that all these are matters for precise control of gene expression.
So all of this three-dimensional structure, the chromatin, is it static, or is the chromatin always like moving around, or do we even know that?
I would say it's quite dynamic and definitely cell type specific, especially at the level of, in terms of regulatory loops between enhancer and the promoter. This is how, you know, some cells know, oh, you know, your heart cell knows turn on like heart related functional genes versus your eyes, you know, have all these visual capabilities because different gene sets has been turned on, and due to the chromatin looping events are drastically different in between these cell types.
So, you know, if you just look in the electron microscope at a nucleus, you'll see all the chromatin, and you can identify cell types in the brain by the arrangement of the chromatin. Like, this one's very dense and it forms clumps, and this one is spread out. Is that meaningful? Is that the kind of 3D thing that we're thinking about?
Yeah, in theory, it is. But, you know, in reality, it's probably going to require really high-resolution microscope to see that. But what we know, like, for example, embryonic stem cells, these are the cells are pluripotent that can turn into different lineages. These cells are actually quite loose in terms of a chromatin environment, that, you know, there's a big portion of the genome has been transcribed, and there's a lot of, you know, poised region that are ready to be transcribed. So, you know, when the differentiation starts, the cell can respond quickly. This is a genome that we know it's quite loose. Okay, but in terminal differentiated cells, for example, neurons, these are the genome more compact. They only express some specialized gene that's needed for neuronal function. Majority of the rest of the genome are shut down. And then their heterochromatins are more compact. Yeah, so definitely there is cell type distinguished between, you know, how the genomes are organized, depending on, you know, what stage they are, like what kind of function they need to be achieved.
The cells differentiate by turning off everything they don't want.
Yes, correct.
And leaving the rest of it to go. So when there's a mutation in one of these non-coding regions, then this, it would likely, I mean, if it's in a promoter, I guess it would just affect one gene.
Yes.
But if it's in an enhancer, it could affect a whole bunch. How many?
We don't know. We don't have that answer, right? So over the years, the field has already, say, using biochemical signatures and trying to identify where these enhancer regions are. However, you know, that's, even though that serves as a good proxy, it doesn't really provide functional results, right? We don't know, like, enhancer could regulate multiple genes, or multiple genes could be, one gene can be regulated by multiple enhancers, or could this happen? This is very complex. So right now we are trying to tease it apart by characterizing enhancer function individually, either in individual experiments or in high throughput fashion. However, to really address your question, I think that requires some combinatory testing, right? So like, say, knocking down a knockout enhancer, multiple ones simultaneously, see how that affects neighboring gene expression. Or, you know, doing these sort of things in different states that also you're gonna see differently. So it's an enormously complex question.
So I guess some of the diseases that we're interested in might arise because of mutations in the non-coding region, and those would present themselves to us experimentally, and it, like, completely different way. We wouldn't be able to easily find the gene that is responsible.
Yeah, so the problem of the genetics right now for a lot of complex diseases is that these patients don't have a clear protein coding mutation. At the same time, you know, when we do genome-wide association study between patients versus healthy controls, we already identify like thousands of genetic variations that associate with certain disease or traits. but they are not in the protein coding region, right? That pose a challenge of how to interpret their results. And it turns out they are highly enriched in cis-regulatory elements like enhancers in a cell type specific manner. But, you know, you would imagine in order to really understand it, first of all, you need to know where the enhancers are for each of the cell type that's being affected. And second is, if you know where they are, and then you can sort of prioritize the variant, but you still don't know where the target genes are. You still have to study, like, what genes they are regulating. And the next is, if they are regulating certain genes, what's effect size, right? And then if you ultimately, you know, say all this worked out, you already identified target gene, you still want to know, like, at beyond the molecular level, at a cellular level, physiological level, how that's relevant to disease, how that, you know, little change of transcription can translate to individuals' elevated risk for disease.
That seems like a big job. How do you start? You start by finding cis-regulatory elements that are changed in some disease and then try to go downstream from them. Is that the right?
Yeah, so we typically start from, you know, say if I'm interested in a certain disease, like taking Alzheimer's disease as example, we would like to first ask the question, what's the most relevant cell type? Of course, many cell types contribute to Alzheimer's, right? But giving, like, I have no information how individuals risk being elevated, of course, I want to pick a cell type that has most abundance of genetic heritability for Alzheimer's disease. So, yes, you're right. So we start from mapping where the enhancers are in a bunch of cell types that could be relevant to Alzheimer's disease. When I say we as a field, right, not just me. So the field basically start to mapping all sorts of enhancer, and, you know, get enhancer annotations in different cell types. And then we can collectively say, oh, you know, this cell type, microglia, had the most enrichment for Alzheimer's disease associated genetic variation. Therefore, you know, potentially these enhancers are being disrupted or being, you know, having reduced affinity to transcription factor binding sites, therefore, you know, affect gene expression.
So that's not just hypothetical. They really are microglia that have the most abundant.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Isn't that a little surprising? I mean, I don't think the Alzheimer's field has normally gravitated toward thinking microglia are the.
You're right. Focus. Yeah. So, you know, I remember when I was postdoc, the field has not recognized that until when I think initially was the macrophage, when people start to have enhancer maps for macrophage. I think that they did like 100 cell types, which was epigenome roadmap projects or ENCODE projects, right? Both of them did many cell types. And they start to, you know, use these enhancer map to go against all these genetic variations associated with many of the human complex traits and disease. And then what they see is, oh, macrophage enhancer are really enriched for a lot of Alzheimer's disease associated genetic variations. This is where people start to hypothesize microglia, you know, which is the resident immune cell in the brain. It's just like, you know, similar to microglia, right, in the hematopoiesis system. So they start to recognize microglia could potentially have this genetic enrichment, but not until much later in Chris Glass lab and other labs, they start to map microglia enhancer landscape in microglia that's actually derived from human brain. That made it us to realize, oh, microglia has a lot of enrichment for these genetic factors that link to Alzheimer's disease.
And I think for DNA methylation as well, glial cells like astrocytes and microglia potentially both have, you know, kind of seem to be showing the effects more so than neuronal cells.
So how many candidate spots are there? I mean, how many enhancers are we looking at that are changed? And is it the same set from one Alzheimer's patient to another? Are they all different?
I don't know for patients, because right now what I'm hoping to achieve is, say, can we study normal individual just to get the baseline where the enhancers are, like how they function microglia and how that relate to Alzheimer's disease, and then we use genetic tools to create iPSL clones that carry these mutations at enhancers, and to figure out how that affect target gene, downstream target gene expression. However, there are many others working in this field, and they start to map the chromatin accessibilities in patient sample versus control. They do actually, but they are still analyzing, not at the individual level, I think as a group, right? Like how Alzheimer's disease, the brain cells are epigenetically different from the control individual brain cells, but not at the individual level yet.
So for the other task, if we just wanted to find out what the function of the enhancers are in microglia, might there not be large? I mean, how many enhancers would we have to catalog and study? Do we have a lead? Which ones ought we to start with? Do we know how to do that, to pick the good ones?
Yeah, so I think if you are coming from the disease angle, right, we already have these genetic variations that's mapped by genetics, population genetic studies called genome-wide association studies, where they have already identified a few dozens of, I think it's close to like 100 loci that's Alzheimer's disease risk loci, right? And then, you know, we also have genome-wide maps where the enhancers are in microglia, so you can intersect the two maps and ask, what are the Alzheimer's disease risk loci overlap with the enhancer regions? Therefore, you know, potentially they are regulatory variants that affect gene expression.
If we do that, how many do we end up with? I had to keep asking how many, but I'm trying to get an idea of the scope of the problem.
I don't have the number on top of my head. I think it must be in the order of hundreds, if not thousands.
So it's big.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Because, you know, we have to keep in mind these variants are common variants, right? Means like many people have them. Mm. And they exert very small effect sizes. So it's not just one variant that could determine you will ultimately get Alzheimer's disease. Oftentimes it's a combination of different variants in your genome plus environmental influence that leads to individuals' disease risk. So it's not like you have these monogenic disease mutations that, you know, you have a mutation, it's almost certain you're going to follow the classic Mendelian, you know, rules that you're going to get that phenotype. It's not that the case.
Variants that, you know, increase risk by a very small amount, and yeah, the variants that one person has with Alzheimer's disease are going to be different to what someone else has with the same disease potentially. But a lot of those sort of risk variants, you know, can often converge on distinct biological pathways too.
So that sounds like it was very discouraging for a moment what you were saying. The convergence onto something, like if there's a lot of different ones, each one makes a small contribution, mm-hmm, but they're all having in common that they're controlling some particular physiological function.
Or potentially multiple physiological functions.
That's why we try to identify target genes for enhancers that contain Alzheimer's disease variants. Because the reason, you know, is we want to know what are the genetic, what are the biological processes that can be affected.
So what's the strategy for that? Can you just remove an enhancer and then look at the phenotype the way you can with the gene?
I don't see that as an effective strategy, as because I said, you know, each of the variant contribute very little to the risk factors, right? What I see the value of this work is, first of all, it helps us to have a better interpretation of the human genome, which is basic science, right? Mm-hmm. And second is you can basically calculate individual, if it's all well characterized, right, in ideal situation, you can calculate individuals' risk based on their genome sequences, and this way, you will be able to identify people in general population who are at a high risk, who are at a low risk, right? This allow them to maybe adopt a better lifestyle to, you know, to delay the onset of disease, or getting them monitored so they get treatments earlier, which, you know, could be much more effective than you go to clinic much later in your disease progress. So that's ultimately, like Melanie mentioned, if we were able to identify convergence of pathways, that potentially give you therapeutic targets on that pathway instead of manipulating individual enhancers, because they are just not they're not exerting like overall big effect size on disease risk.
So is there are there promoters, enhancers, and everything that control transcription factor transcription? I'm starting to think about transcription of transcription factors. Like, what controls the transcription factors?
Transcription factors.
Oh, their own promoters and enhancers.
and then their transcription factors?
Yes.
The transcription factors all the way down.
Yeah,
you can have kind of these like master regulators.
Like, for example, you know, in the gene regulation field, people has a term called pioneer factors, right? So these factors actually have chromatin remodeling capacity, can go in and remodel the chromatin from repressive to active chromatin state. That way, you know, once the chromatin is opened up, the DNA gets exposed, then other transcriptional factor can come in and bind, potentially turn on the genes, could be another transcriptional factor, right? Or other, you know, other protein genes.
Yeah. So I'm just starting to imagine a kind of hierarchy of transcription factors, where this one would have its effect by turning on a bunch of others.
Yes.
And then
it's a cascade event.
There would be a master transcription factor somewhere that could click on a whole a cell type, maybe. Will we ever discover that? I mean, there are a lot of transcription factors too, right?
Yeah, I think there are people doing like gene regulatory network analysis in that area, which I don't do. Like, they're talking about a lot of like trans effects, like how transcription factor binds to their targets and stuff like that. Yeah, I think there are people doing like co-expression network. This kind of computational analysis help you to understand how things work in a network.
Because we're used to think about, there's a constellation of transcription factors and various epigenetic controllers that create a cell type, brain microglia or excitatory neurons. Mm-hmm. And then there's probably ones that control the whole tissue. This is heart. This is brain, right? Is that right? Do you think there is?
Tissues, when you say tissue, could be really complex, right? Even though you think heart has, you know, mostly are heart muscles, but you still get like other cell types.
Yeah.
So I think.
So I'm thinking about constellation of cell types the same way.
Maybe early on during the lineage specification, right? There are like particular transcription factors where important for the lineage specification for multiple like sublineages, but then the further along you are in differentiation, in development, then it gets more specialized in terms of transcriptional factor function.
So is this stuff species specific? Is there like are there a set of like human specifying things that are different from dog specify?
It depends. Some is the same, some is different.
Right.
So, you know,
that sounds like in some ways we're like dogs and some
yes, true. But yeah, you definitely have this conservation, you know, across a lot of the, you know, transcription factors, across enhancers, across all of these regulatory regions.
Yeah.
But then if you look just at the structure of, you know, different species genomes, you know, all of that non-coding DNA is very different. Sort of across the species, and so
somehow,
there's this opportunity for this individual
non-coding
regulation
DNA is what makes humans stand out again.
Yes, so, yeah. Like, so yeah.
All of this, the same enzymes.
So, yeah. I mean, we probably all grew up in the era where we heard about junk DNA, and we were taught that, you know, half the, you know, most of the genome is this junk DNA. 98%. But now we know that, no, it's not junk. It's kind of what helps to regulate everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's probably a whole lot of functions we still don't even have any idea about.
Yeah. So many years ago, we did a conservation study of protein coding region like exomes, right? We get a conservation score across multiple vertebrates. And then we also did that for enhancer regions. And definitely enhancer is less conserved compared to exon regions. Uh-huh. But there are regions that's highly conserved, I have to say, not only at DNA sequence level, but also at epigenetic level. Like, for example, if you compare like a heart gene that's in a conserved pathway, not only the gene expression is very similar, but also the decoration of the biochemical signatures like histone modifications nearby for enhancers are also very similar. But given that said, you know, we know that enhancer sequences contain many of the transposon elements, which is, you know, the biggest like drive for evolution. Right, so our genome, like more than half of our genome are viral sequences, like ritual transposon elements. They are highly enriched in the enhancer regions. That contains a lot of, I think that is contributed to like species-specific gene regulation.
So that's where we should look. If we want to find out what makes one species that species, including us.
At the protein level, I would say it's more conserved compared to the non-coding regulatory sequences levels.
So if that's where we should look, somebody's looking. What do we know about that?
I'm not the person who are looking at, like my friends or other colleagues that, you know, they are really actively looking how transposon elements are play a role in evolution, in gene regulation, and these sort of things, even in Alzheimer's, you know.
So how about identifying the specific sequences that are human, that are uniquely human?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something people have done? Do we have a catalog of human-specific
sequences? This has been done for many years, you know, from my colleagues, Katie Poland's early pioneer work. They did a computational alignment, right, across multiple vertebrates. And what they noticed is that the sequence, there are many sequences that are highly conserved, except when the human divergent between human and the other primates' genome. So in the case there's a rapid evolution, accelerated evolution in the human genome, makes us very different from the other primates. So these sequences, last time I checked, is about like over more than 3,000 of them. Okay, so they are mostly in the non-coding region, still remain to be large characterized.
So, yeah, some of the non-coding region, we know what it does, right? Like enhancer or promoter.
Yeah.
But some of the non-coding region is still
certainly
mysterious.
Yes, certainly. We don't
feel like calling it junk anymore, but we don't know what it does.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yes.
So it's a large proportion, right? It's like a very large proportion.
It is. Yeah. We consider we might have up to 1 million of such regulatory sequences in the non-coding region that controls about 10,000 genes.
Ah, more controllers than there are things.
Yes.
It sounds like regular work. There's more managers than anything else, right?
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie.
For joining us. Yeah. That was really cool.
It was great.
Melanie.
Thank you, Charlie.
That was fun. And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.